welcome to Conductor's Brew. And Matt, how are you doing over there in the winter wonderland on your side of the neighborhood?
Wait, which Matt? Oh, the neighborhood.
Well, McKeever is here, but we don't know about his neighborhood yet.
He's in an undisclosed location in Wisconsin.
That's right.
And he said he got 2 feet of snow last week.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, no, hello, Larry, and welcome back to Conductor's Brew. Yes, we have two mats again today, and I am loving this weather. It is snowing right now, and it has been snowing all day. We were hoping to meet outside, but we haven't been able to do that in a couple weeks because we finally have a real winter, which is good because we're like feet below our normal water allowance for the season. So if we don't get some major weather here, we're gonna be in big trouble for fire season next year. So
yeah, it's where all our water comes in the wintertime, and of course the skiing needs the snow. But yeah, we've been thwarted several weeks in a row by weather, but it is beautiful and we do love the snow. And just looking outside, it's still coming down, man. It's piling up out there.
It's so pretty. We've transitioned from the big kind of conglomerate flakes that look like a snow globe to sort of like the really thin sort of I guess fluffier snow.
It's the snow I think of with Utah, the very dry little snowflakes. I think of the big fluffy ones. That's kind of reminds me of back east, the wetter kind of snow, I guess.
Yes.
I don't know. What do I know of snow?
No, I think that's right. I think it's getting a little bit colder. The plow truck, I don't know about you, but the plow truck just came by my house a few minutes ago. So it's getting real out there.
Well,
when you're plowing, it's real.
Well, your avenue is a little more of a bit more of a thoroughfare. Fourth Avenue is kind of a backwater in terms of streets here, so we don't get plowed very often. But they'll get to it eventually. So anyway, yes, it's a beautiful snowy day here in Salt Lake City. But we have the power of Zoom, and here we are all together again. And today is Stravinsky Day. We're coming up on the 50th anniversary of his passing. It's 50 years that he's been gone, and so we wanted to mark that and talk a little bit about his
April 6th, I believe.
Yeah, I think so.
Check. Yeah.
So
born June 17th, 1882, died April 6th, 1971. So it's a big Stravinsky year.
Yeah, big Stravinsky year, and just kind of taking a look back at his life. But before we get into that, as is our custom, let's talk some coffee, Manella. What you got over there?
Before we get into that,
oh, okay.
Before I forget, your poster behind you has reminded me that there is a CODA symposium coming up next weekend. The February the 11th through 13th, I believe, is when the symposium is happening. We had on our wonderful College Orchestra Directors Association president last week, Kim Cherie Lloyd. And she was really, really nice and talked to us for, a long time about all sorts of things. And we'd also discuss the upcoming symposium. And just wanted to remind everybody that if you're not a CODA member and you'd like to be, now's the time to join because it's free for members. It'll be online this year.
Yeah, it's going to be. I just spoke with Chris Dobbins this morning. I zoomed in and did a class for him on Laban movement analysis with his second year or second semester conducting students, and his students are doing some stuff from presentations, but he's on it about getting all the technology down. So it's going to be obviously different, but it sounds like it's going to be really a rewarding experience. So join up with CODA if you haven't already, because it is a great organization. Obviously the conferences are the highlight of the year, in my opinion, but CODA does things throughout the year. The listserv, we have the Boeing Library, a lot of other resources. So join up with CODA. It's a great place to connect with colleagues. And it'll be a big part of your career if you're involved with college orchestra conducting.
There have been, speaking of resources, there have been some great resources going around recently in recent weeks about repertoire for reduced ensembles. And that all, of course, is an outgrowth of our need to reduce ensemble sizes due to COVID concerns. But that's a big draw. I mean, that's so many people have done some really tremendous amounts of work and great work in finding smaller instrumentations and also works by underrepresented composers. So that's a big draw if that's something that you're interested in as well.
Tons of repertoire resources out there for CODA. All right, good. Well, thank you for reminding us of that, Matt, because we definitely want to promote CODA. It's an organization that's meant a lot to both of us over the years. So sign up now and check it out. Okay, let's get on to the coffee. Manella, you've got
some late in the day for me for coffee.
That's true.
But no, I mean, I will drink coffee until 3 or 4, but I'll be up all night. No, I am drinking tea right now. I've got this smoked tea, which I believe I've actually brought on the show before. It's been a while.
Smoked
tea? The snow
tea?
Makes me want this sort of tea. Yes, it is Chinese tea. I'm going to probably butcher the pronunciation, but the label on the bag says Lapsang Souchong.
All right.
And it is just regular old tea that they then process by drying it over pine smoke. And so it has this really wonderful, almost malted, smoky smell. It reminds me of scotch, actually, a really smoky scotch, but in a nice way. It's not too astringent. And it smells sort of like campfire, and it just tastes really warm and a little smoky, but it's really just a wonderful, light, malty tea that is perfect for these sorts of wintry days. So that's what I'm enjoying right now. What about you all?
Well, yeah, that sounds great. You know, if it's a if you don't have a fireplace, you can have your own little fireplace and a cup on a snowy day.
When we get your chimney over here, we'll throw in a fire and have some smoked tea with the chimney.
There it goes. Well, you know, if the weather will eventually cooperate for us, we'll do that. But yeah, that sounds delicious. I would love to try some of that. Well, what I'm having, Matt, is I'm having some La Barba. You got me onto La Barba there, this the local Salt Lake City company. Some Colombian.
Which Colombian?
Yeah. Santa Rosa. It's the stone fruit, and I've made it in my siphon for the first time, and it is quite noticeably more flavor packed. So the siphon is doing well. So quite good.
I'm so glad to hear that.
So shout out to La Barba, and to you, Matt, for hooking me up with that.
I've got well, thanks. Also, but you know, of course, I'm glad you're enjoying it. I mean, it's all about sharing the love, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I've got a little sneak peek. I've got some coffees coming up in the next couple of weeks that will be new and exciting, things I have not tried before. So stay tuned. In the next couple of weeks, I'll be back to the siphon. I haven't done the siphon in a while.
Coffee adventure with the siphon. All right. Well, we'll look forward to that. Okay, McKeever, we've alluded to your presence, but we'll now officially bring you in here. Good to have you back, my friend, one of our regular crew members, and apparently has some coffee that's going to be coming our way at some point, I hear. It's a tribute, if you will, maybe, to Conductor's Brew. So what you got over there, McKeever?
At some point, I think maybe I should just ask this coffee company if they'd make a special brew for us. You know,
oh, there you go.
So much advertisement for them on our show. You know, good marketing play for them. So I again am back in Wisconsin for those of you who are listening and keeping up with my travels. You know, I'm
the world wants to know where Matt McKeever is.
Where in the world is Matt McKeever? I am still in Wisconsin, where I will be for a while. I am once again enjoying some Stone Creek coffee. This is a medium roast, washed blend from multiple regions. It's called Voyager. Mm. And I figured that since I have the pleasure right now of speaking to some, lack of a better term, Star Trek nerds.
Indeed.
Voyagers and Star Trek Voyager.
I thought that you guys would enjoy the name. It does say boldly go at the bottom of it. And there's going to be a bag coming your way in the next week or so.
Does it say what kind of roast it is?
It is a... It doesn't say what kind of a roast it is. I mean, it's a medium roast.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's what I was looking for.
So it's a multiple farm, multiple region. It says the variety is a Quechua heirloom bourbon.
Oh, yeah.
Not to be confused with bourbon.
The bourbon, I guess, is it bourbon? I don't know.
Bourbon, it's like Spanish, right?
Oh, I have no idea. Yeah. You know what? I think it might be – oh, gosh. You know – a shout out to my father back in Connecticut who sent me a book about coffee. I was just reading about this. That particular variety, I mean, there's like hundreds of different varieties that have been developed over the years, but I think the general consensus is coffee developed out of Ethiopian varieties. And that particular variety, bourbon or bourbon, however you say it, bourbon would be French, I think, I don't know, is supposed to be one of the earlier, most popular and productive varieties. So that's no surprise. But I'm glad that they have on there such detailed information. I mean, usually you don't get that anywhere near that level of information on the bag. So it's kind of surprising, but it's also a good sign because usually you just don't know where you're getting your coffee from. And the vast majority of coffee, I would say 99%, that's just my educated guess, I guess, is it's hard to trace because there's so much made. And because of the trade itself, it's not conducive to being able to track the product back to the farmers, which we're trying to change, I think, because it's often one of those things where the farmers don't really get paid what they need to get paid for the product. So looking forward to sampling some of that, Matt, at some point. The reason I asked about the roast level is I have this sort of like innate fear of bold things. When people say, oh, this is a bold coffee, I can almost guarantee you if it's like just random, you know, coffee, that they're marketing it as bold because it's over roasted. It's so dark, it's bold, which is not the case. I mean, it's just burnt, really. If bold equals burnt, then I guess that's right. But I don't think bold should equal burnt. So medium roast, that's about as dark as I'm willing to go at this point. So we'll see.
I can guarantee you that it's not burnt. I can definitely tell you that.
Oh, well, I'm looking forward to that. I'm jealous of your undisclosed locationing because I really want to smell that coffee right now.
Well, I'll also tell you, I got a text from my mom today, and it just kind of made me giggle because I didn't see the picture that was associated with it at first, and it just said, try this today, expensive but good, and then the picture came with it. And it's the Stumptown Hairbender.
Oh yeah,
which I think we had on this show before.
We did. I think we got about as over caffeinated as is possible on that Hairbender indeed. And you know, coffee is one of those things though that you kind of get what you pay for, I found.
Well fair enough. And McKeever, I will say that I'm looking forward to this coffee because I'm sure it'll taste good, but also Voyager has, in my opinion, and this might be a throwdown moment, the best theme song of all the Star Trek franchises.
Oh, you did not just say
yes,
that.
Yes, I did. The best. I love the March for Next Generation. I learned to conduct to that. I practiced my four pattern to the march for to the march theme of Star Trek Next Generation. But Voyager has the best theme song. There it is.
Oh, you're just talking about the music. You're not talking about the series. It's
well, no, I like the series too, but I'm saying the theme song for Voyager is the best.
Da 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 da.
Yeah, something like that. Yes,
I'm kind of massacring.
Yeah, this is some good French horn licks in there. But yeah, I love it. It's. I mean, there it is. Okay. Yeah, we. That's what the mute button's for there, Manella. Have those thoughts in your head.
Okay, this is kind of a nerd moment.
Okay, yeah, it's well into the nerd moment time.
I've got a nerd moment because you just reminded me of it. Both of you is talking about theme songs and Star Trek. So if you ever go through the Next Generation season by season, the music stays the same. You know, like the title music, the theme music stays the same, but you could tell they're different recordings. Like they got a bigger budget or something after the first or second season, and they re-recorded everything.
I didn't notice that.
It might be between seasons 2 and 3, but it's a marked difference in not only the sound quality but also accuracy. Which this is not to pan anybody or to give anybody a hard time. It's like when you have studio time and you have to record something like that. For those who don't know how the business works, you have basically what 15 minutes maybe for a 90 second snippet of music that you have to record. You don't have a ton of rehearsal time, if any rehearsal time. They're probably studio musicians. They're just coming in. They're sight reading most likely, and that's why they're hired, because they can sight read and not have to take up a lot of rehearsal time. And so they come in to do it, and mistakes get made. It's fine. Most viewers would have no idea. But there is a difference. Maybe we can go back and actually at some point do a Star Trek show and just talk about the music of Star Trek through the years.
Robert Baldwin needs to be a guest of that show. I'm just going to put it that way.
Has to happen. I'm going to send out the text message.
All right, you get on that. You're a show booker. You're the show booker. Okay. All right. Well, wow, that was epically nerdy, and at my own peril, I invite more nerdiness. McKeever, we're going to do Manella's nerd moment at the end because it's a nerd moment / rant. But McKeever, you got a cool nerd moment.
I do, and this, you know, falls, I think, very well with part of our topic of discussion today. Not necessarily with Stravinsky, but with the Stravinsky piece that we're going to look at the most, I think. And the discussion that Matt had, you know, brought in during the intro, and talking about Coda and all of the resources that, you know, they have on their website, that now they're you know, giving all of us conductors supplemental material of, you know, works with smaller instrumentation. Over the last couple weeks, I've really gotten into this reduced orchestration of Mahler 4 by Erwin Stein. And there's a really great performance of it by the Digital Concert Hall, the Berlin Philharmonic Digital Concert Hall, that is just... It's remarkable. None of like the real orchestral quality is really diminished by the orchestration, and I just think that it's a really fabulous work, and excited to dive into more of that personally someday.
That sounds great. So 14 instruments, as you said?
Yes, 14, and I think that's including the vocal soloist.
Wow.
It's one flute, one oboe, one clarinet, one bassoon, string quartet, double bass, piano, four hands, harmonium, two percussionists, and the soprano.
That's amazing, because as we've talked about before, I mean, one of the issues with the coronavirus is the number of people you can have in a room over a given period of time. Even if it's a really big room and it's spaced out, you know, the aerosols build up. So you want to limit that down, and the chance to be able to do a work like that in the time of COVID is just, that's wonderful. That's absolutely amazing. So the score and parts are already out. Is that what you said?
They are not for public rental. I think that you have to. You can rent them, but it's not, you know, public domain sort of thing.
You can't purchase. They're not for sale. They're for rent.
No.
It's a rental only.
Rental only.
Wait, who's the publisher?
That's a very good question. I'll let you know as soon as I locate, you know, things that are in my underground bunker.
All right, yeah, he's got to go search his bunker. His bunker's bunker.
Look that up right now.
Okay, good. Well, let's thank you for that, McKeever, for bringing us some new information or new piece out there, or version of a piece that can be done in this time of COVID. All right, so we're going to get on to our topic today. We're talking about Igor Stravinsky, as we mentioned. It's coming up on the 50th anniversary of his passing. And, you know, Stravinsky...
Wait, who? Stravinsky? Who's Stravinsky? I'm just kidding. Obviously, we have to talk about Stravinsky this week. I mean, it's a big year for Stravinsky.
Yeah, absolutely. And, the one thing I've always found so interesting about him is just the sheer diversity of styles that he's had. Over the course of his career, you know, he studied with Rimsky-Korsakov. So he has this rooting in the, you know, Russian school, the, you know, romantic tradition, and then goes through these different periods. He's got his Russian period. He's got his neoclassical period and his serial period. Very, very different approaches to music, but at the same time, still this sort of thread of Stravinskyism throughout. It's quite a fascinating, output and quite a fascinating person.
Larry, do you have a favorite Stravinsky period? I mean, Stravinsky, he's kind of maybe one of the only 20th century composers who has periods like like Beethoven. Like, we don't often talk about composers of having separate periods. Like, really only if their output is that prolific. Mm-hmm. But Stravinsky's, he's got such different styles and different periods. Do you have a like preferred pieces or preferred sounds of Stravinsky?
Well, I've done the pieces I've done from Stravinsky. I've only done pieces from his Russian period. I've done Firebird. I haven't performed Rite of Spring, but I was the assistant conductor when we did it at the U several years ago. So I got to work with it and do rehearsals. And then I've done Soldier's Tale which is one of his later Russian period pieces. So I haven't done anything like Symphony of Psalms or anything like that from the more serial period, neoclassical period. But the Russian primitivism stuff. I don't know. I'm really drawn to it because I like that. I like that sort of emotional intensity of that music. You know, it kind of reminds me of that, of the expressionism, painting movement at the time. Edvard Munch's The Scream, that really kind of just intense early 20th century, just bite and passion, that I hear from the music from that period. So I've been kind of drawn to that aspect of it.
Matt, what about you? Do you have a favorite Stravinsky or a certain period that you prefer or certain pieces that you prefer?
Certain pieces, certainly. If I had to say a certain period, I would probably, go alongside Larry, especially the three ballet scores are just, it's some of the most intense music to this day. And recognizable. We love the Rite of Spring. And I think I've said, I've had the opportunity to perform it, and I've heard it twice in concert with professional orchestras, and it's still just one of those things that you're on the edge of your seat for, even though it's now, 108 years old. Mm. I personally find Petrushka to be, I don't want to say a greater work, but I think a more interesting sound. It's harder in some ways than the Rite of Spring. I think that Petrushka is just a phenomenal piece. I haven't had the opportunity to conduct any Stravinsky in performance, to be honest. I have done a couple of selections from the Rite for auditions, and then I've done part of Soldier's Tale and part of Dumbarton Oaks for some workshop stuff, but nothing in its entirety and nothing for performance.
What portions of Soldier's Tale did you get to do? That's the only Stravinsky I've been able to perform as well. I'm curious if we overlap in any of that.
I got to do the March du Soldat, the reprise. So the reprise of the opening, and then the it's the Royal March.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the March Royale. I've done both of those in a workshop with members of the Austin Symphony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did a performance of Soldier's Tale, so we'll compare notes on that one in just a minute. But I want to, before we move off of the ballets, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Rite of Spring. So 1913, right? That's when it was premiered. And the funny thing is, at least I do, I think of the Rite of Spring, oh, that's modern music. That's modern music. I know it wasn't written yesterday, but it feels modern. It's over, like you said, 108 years old. Like, is that really modern music anymore? I mean, probably not, but it had its impact at the time was so intense, and because of some of the cutting edge things it did, I think that's why it kind of sticks in our minds as being quite a modern piece of music. One thing I will say from a programming standpoint that it's difficult about the Rite of Spring is the number of people that are involved. It takes a ton of people. When we did it at the University of Utah, we actually combined up with Utah State and did a joint performance here and another one up in Logan. because it required all those extra wins. And the thing is like, it's only like, was it 30 minutes long or something like that?
Yeah, it feels like it's 2 hours.
Yeah, it's amazing. So like you do that and then you got to do something else for a concert. I'm like, man, is that not enough? Is that not enough?
That reminds me of one fantastic program that the Utah Symphony did. I think at the end of one of their seasons a couple of years ago, they did Stravinsky's Rite of Spring on the first half, and they did Amerique on the second half. Verez, yes. Mm. And it was just like the orchestra sounded fantastic, but it was just like, that's a lot of work for one concert. That's a lot to work up.
Yeah, it's a beast. And I was just looking at my score here for the Rite of Spring in the beginning when I was working on this, because I would do rehearsals and you know, conducted sectionals and all kinds of stuff. But I have, and I don't remember exactly what I'm referring to, but I have a series of measures where I wrote down that I had to memorize them, because like you can't. It's going by fast, and you can't just sort of rely on looking down at the score. And then looking in at the end of it, at the, of course, the famous sacrificial dance and all those time changes. And I just have all of these meter changes marked in the score really big so I could see it, because it was just so much, so many things changing. And it was my first year of my doctorate, so I did get better at conducting. At least I hope I do. Hope I did. But I remember when I got
like Rite of Spring to whip you into shape.
Yeah, well, that I also auditioned with this. Baldwin made me audition with this. Sort of. We didn't play it. No, I didn't play it in front of the orchestra. I had to conduct it in a lesson with him. That's what it was. I auditioned with Beethoven 5, and I think it was Force of Destiny. The overture from Verdi. That's the one. Anyway, but I remember getting to the end of the sacrificial dance, and you know, it was like, it was just hold on for dear life kind of thing, just hoping it got through, and it did. But anyway, you know, Stravinsky presents, and not just Rite of Spring, but I can attest to Soldier's Tale too, quite a challenge for conductors. And Soldier's Tale, it's another good small ensemble piece. It has seven players. You know, you could theoretically do it without a conductor, but I don't know how one would get that done. So Stravinsky has a ton of work for conductors to do, you know, and especially in those two pieces, been my experience. Okay, so getting back to the Rite of Spring. Matt, you said you had Manella. You said you had conducted some of that. What have you done with that?
Did I?
I thought you I did. Know. Maybe I was hallucinating. Oh, it was McKeever. I'm sorry. I'm getting my maths confused. Has, yeah. What did you do with the Rite of Spring, McKeever?
So I got to do the section that comes right after the 11 hits.
Yeah, the 11 four bar, right?
Yeah. Yep, yeah, I got to do that and the sacrificial dance for an audition at Ithaca.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there it is, the 11-4 bar.
Yeah,
you know,
the famous 11 downbeats.
Yeah, yeah. Do you try to work that into a pattern, or is it just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5?
I show the last three as a 3-4.
That's completely right. Just the last three is a 3-4.
There you go. That makes sense. Yeah. So the naming of the chosen one. That's the thing right off the 11-4. Yeah. That's one of my favorite spots, by the way, that section of it. Yeah. So anyway, so we and you did the sacrificial dance too?
I did.
Yeah. That's it's a call to sacrifice for a reason. It's the conductor who is the sacrifice at the end of it.
It separates the conductors from the non-conductors.
The people who don't get into graduate school.
I feel like they should literally give you like a mini bottle of scotch or bourbon and
vodka
and like four ibuprofen at the end of it.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. Did you guys ever hear about somebody had rebarred that into all two? Who was that?
I've looked into this. This is there's a couple different rebarrings. The famous one is a Nicholas Leninsky rebarring that Bernstein adapted.
Yeah,
and you can see these in separate scores. And actually, Stravinsky himself rebarred. He didn't rebar it. I would say he changed his mind. So actually, you can if you look at the original, thankfully we've got a facsimile of, I think it's Monteux's conducting score that was one of the original copies. Some of it's different, and some of it has different things written in it in terms of where the bars are, what the meters are. But Slonimsky's is the big one. He tries to take a lot of the 16 bars, the denominator, you know, 16th notes.
Mm-hmm.
Those meters, he tries to change those, combine those to turn them into 8 denominator times,
right,
which is a little easier to think about. But having really comprehensively gone bar by bar and phrase by phrase and compared that whole section to back and forth, backwards and forwards, and 80 times in a row or whatever, it's actually really, really feasible the way it's barred in the score. It's just there's certain patterns that you have to look out for that you can kind of make hypermeters out of. But the rebarring thing itself is fascinating, just because it's like, should the music, you know, it presents that question, should the barring, should the notation reflect how it sounds, or should it reflect some other structure? And that's one of the giant questions, I think, in Stravinsky's output, especially in Petrushka, with all the different versions of Petrushka and how he changed the time signatures in a lot of places. You know, what did he want? How did he want it to feel? Was he just changing it to make it easier or harder or what? Like, what's the answer there? I'm not sure we have an answer.
Yeah. And just to back up real quick, you mentioned the thing about the denominator or something like that, 16. What we're talking about here is that, for those not familiar, we're talking about the time signature. So, you know, if you have a bar of like 4-4 with a 4 in the bottom, the quarter note equals the beat. With an 8 on the bottom, the 8th note equals the beat. With a 16 on the bottom, the 16th note equals the beat. And so there's spots here where he's got a bar of 2-16 and then 4-16. You know? And so, and like, combining it together so that it's not a bar with 2/16th notes in it and another bar with 4/16th notes in it. Maybe it's one bar with 3/8th notes in it.
Yeah. And to be clear, his use of it isn't exactly what we would call orthodox. I mean, like the 3/16 bars and the 2/16 bars, does the 16th really get the beat there? I don't think it does. It's a bar unto itself is a beat. But it just happens to have smaller or different subdivisions. Like you could call it a 1/8 bar and say the 8th note gets the beat, which I think is more accurate, rather than a 2/16. But he's showing different patterns, I think.
Well, when I conducted, again, this was, you know, junior spaceman conductor Larry. I do have a 6, so I counted the 16ths, in, at least in my head, when I conducted. But I combined the 2/16 and the 4/16 into one hypermetered concept that I thought of as 6/16th notes, for
like
whatever that's
like
worth.
A 3/8 kind of thing?
Yeah, instead of 3/8 notes. Yeah. Anyway, there you go. So,
This is fodder for all sorts of discussion on not just the semiotics of music notation, but the semantics of it and the practicality of different conventions and so on and so forth.
It boils down to whatever's going to keep you from getting lost.
Yeah, whatever, you know, works.
Whatever keeps you and the orchestra from getting lost, that's kind of job one. Okay, great. Well, let's move on and talk, because I also want to talk a bit about Soldier's Tale. Just because, to me, and kind of piggybacking on the whole pandemic protocol, there's another great one that you can do with a small group of people. And the other thing that's really cool about this, especially if you're in an academic environment and you're looking for collaborations across departments, you can collaborate with the dance department, because this has an optional, well, I guess it's optional. I've seen, when we performed it, we didn't have dancers. But, you know, there's dances that go along with Soldier's Tale that can be a part of it. So it calls for a little bit of background on Soldier's Tale. It was written in 1918, so it's towards the end of his Russian period. Russian period was basically 1907 to 1919. And it's based on an old Russian folktale called The Runaway Soldier and the Devil. And it, the basic story is this soldier, he's on his way back home on leave, or maybe he's AWOL. I can't remember exactly sure, but, he runs across the devil on the side of the road. And the devil basically trades him his fiddle for a book that tells information in the future, basically that you could use to, you know, you know, make business deals or something like that. I'm trying to remember exactly how it goes, but some little book that gives them information about the future. Yeah.
Probably something about GameStop, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, not the short GameStop stocks. Oh, God. All right. So basically, you know, it's a deal with the devil kind of a story. And the devil takes him back to his house to show him how the book works. And the guy's supposed to teach the devil how to play fiddle. He thinks 3 days pass, 3 years go back. Sum up, he gets back home and nobody knows who he is anymore. They think he's a ghost or something like that. So then he goes out and basically tries and gets a bunch of money. And to kind of sum things up here, he figures out that the devil's controlling him through all this money that he's got, that he's, you know, he's accumulated all this money. And so he loses all the money in a poker game, and the devil no longer has control over him, and they play this really cool, I can't remember the exact name of the piece, but basically it's this piece that makes the devil dance or something like that. Anyway, so he frees himself from the devil, but in the end, the devil is able to trick him again and get control of him after the soldier's fallen in love with a beautiful princess. Anyway, it's a cool little story, but I digress on it. But it's the point I'm trying to work my way around is it has a lot of different styles in it that fit along with this story. So you've got, not only do you have the march that's at the beginning, which is the soldier's march, but you also have dances. You have a tango, a waltz, this really cool ragtime piece that's kind of gnarly to conduct. There's also klezmer influences. It's got music that's sort of based in the Lutheran chorale style. So it's a very rich, it's about an hour or so to do the whole thing. So it's not short, but it's a relatively compact thing that has just a lot of different styles. It's really interesting from that perspective. And the story is really cool too. So I just think it's a really, great piece of music to do, where you're presenting something again. You know, I think of it as modern, but it's now over 100 years old. But a relatively modern piece of music that's very engaging with an audience. And you have a narrator there who's telling the story. You also have actors who represent the soldier and the devil. And like I said, you can have dancers there as well. So it's just a really great collaborative kind of a piece of music. So I loved doing it. And I think it's a great piece, especially like in these, like I said, these times when we have to use limited forces. Okay, so one of the spots that I found was kind of tricky was the ragtime. And if you take a look at this, I mean, it starts off calmly enough in a nice 2-4 bar, throws in a couple of 3-8 bars, but then there's your 16. There's a 3-16 bar, a 7-16 bar, followed by a 4-8 bar, 5-16, 7-16, 4-8, 5-16, 7-16. It just gets crazy. It's just nothing but all these meter changes in here. And it was just, I remember it being so challenging to kind of hold on to all of that. So Matt, Manel, you said you've done this before. Did you do any modification to these bars to make this work?
Oh, that's a really good question. I'm scanning. I turned, okay, so at rehearsal 30, mm-hmm. where it says 4-8 in parentheses, I just kept it a 4, I kept it 2-4.
Oh, okay, so I did that in 4.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I kept it in 2-4. I think I wanted to differentiate, I think I wanted to be clear that we were out of the craziness.
Yeah.
For at least that moment in time. But I don't see that I've changed anything. It's been a while since I've done this. I don't think I changed anything. The only decisions that I really had to make, of course, were how to divide the 7-16s.
Yeah.
What I did, 5-8s, I guess.
The 7-16s. Yeah, I did it 2+3+2.
That's what I have as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
The music's pretty clear about that.
And by the way, since we have our scores out and we're talking about this, do you guys use symbols? What do you use for marking meters? That especially ones that are of non-traditional sorts, like 7-16 bars. Like, how do you mark that in your score?
Yeah, I have a system for this. It's one I've developed over years. It is, it's based on the common system of using triangles for 3 mm-hmm. and squares for 4. but I use for what I use for 2-4, anything in 2. In fact, I use looks like a backwards check mark, where it's like just a 2 pattern. Yeah, and if depending on the subdivision, I will put a hash mark on either the upper stem or the sideways check mark. Yeah, and so that I can look at a glance. I can know at a glance what I need to be doing. Same goes for other uneven or irregular meters like 7. If it's 2 + 3 + 2, I'll have the triangle and a hash mark through the bottom ray of the triangle, the line. Anything that's in 1, I put in a circle, so I know it's in 1. I don't bother with arrows or anything. What else? I only write in the actual meter in terms of the numbers if it's a change from if the beat itself changes. In other words, if we go from 4-4 to 3-4 to 2-4, I will just use the symbols. If we go from 4-4 to 3-8 to 7-16, I'll actually write in the numbers so that I know that the denominator changes.
Right, the number that represents the beat. Yeah, yes. That makes sense. And I used to use just all numbers, but I, like you, have started using symbols. Mine are similar, a little bit different. When I have like a 3-8 bar where it's in 1, but it's got a 3 subdivision, I use a triangle with an up arrow to kind of indicate that I have to extend up more. But I like you. I use the triangle, the big triangle for like a 3 pattern. And then I put a little tick marks on the longer bar. So I know that one's got a bigger subdivision. Like we were saying, this 7-16 bar, it's 2 + 3 + 2. So on that second one, it would be a little bit, have the hash mark so that it would be indicate that it's a little bit longer. Yeah. And this sort of speaks to the point, I mention this to my conducting students all the time, is that, you know, you want to try and limit how many times you use numbers, because there's sometimes you can't use them for anything. And especially when you're changing meters so many times, like you are in this ragtime, you need to have something where you can just glance down and know what's happening, and a good symbol that really represents not just how long something is, but even maybe the way you move, like your backwards check mark to show the 2 pattern. It really does help in that split second of time that you have to be able to, make a decision and know what you're doing. So that's a shout out for coming up with a good, effective, easy to glance at method of marking your bars, because this thing flies by and you don't have time to ponder and look at the score as you're reading it. Okay, good. So Matt, what else did you do with Soldiers Tell? You said you did the 3 dances. Is that right?
Well, Matt, before that, did you have a system that you wanted to chime in about too?
Sorry, McKeever. Yeah, go ahead.
You guys are good. No, I don't really have one. Aside from, going back to Rite of Spring when I did the sacrificial dance, I did kind of sort of use like what you guys are talking about, like check marks. Except for I did a check mark for anything that I had to do like a 3-4, like a 3-16. And so like I'll just use a tick mark for anything that's like in 2, and then the check mark for anything that's in 3. So if I have like a 7-16 bar here and I'm going to conduct it, like a 2 + 3, then I just have 2 tick marks and a check mark. So tick, 1, 2, 3.
Oh, I see. The tick is 2, the check is 3.
Yeah.
That's for subdivisions. What about big beats or full bars? Do you mark those with 1 symbol?
Yeah. I mean, just kind of do the same thing. And then maybe if there's – this is hard to do, in a Stravinsky score when you do it all the time, every other bar. But sometimes I write in if it's huge – then I'll try to write the meter change. Otherwise, especially if like we're going from like really small beats to like really big beats, I'll put like lines like where the big beats are, and then if it's like a big 3 thing, then same sort of thing where I put like a big triangle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do all you mark tempo changes? Do you mark tempo changes?
That's a good question. I circle them and then I'll try to, write what the new tempo is, unless it's indicated already, giving like an actual like rough metronome marking to it. And if there's, if it's like a really tough, change, tempo change, I try to, you know, maybe like a couple bars before or like right where the tempo change is about to happen, sort of write the process of like what it is. Maybe if it's a, if there is some sort of like subdivision to it, you know, write what the subdivision is. Otherwise, just kind of sort of, you know, a little slower here or how you're getting into it, maybe start a rallentando in this spot, you know, but clearly define if there's like a, if there's a way to get into it, like, just try to be as clear in my writing as possible.
Yeah, I tend to focus on metronome marks too. Like I it helps me to really think in terms of those. So I'll just write really big quarter note equals, you know, 70 or whatever it is, you know, when there's a tempo change, like an abrupt change to a new tempo, or if it's just sort of speeding up and slowing down, forward arrow for speeding up, backwards arrow for slowing down, trying to keep things as simple as possible. So yeah, conducting Stravinsky will make you think about how you do your meter markings and your tempo markings, and you'll come up with a way that'll work. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to make it happen. It's not going to fly.
One thing I find really useful for tempo changes, especially at a page turn, is to, in pencil, mark the old tempo above the tempo change and a slash, and then a new tempo next to it. So on the left side of the slash is the old tempo that I'm coming from, and the right is the new tempo that we're going to. So at a glance, I can see the relationship between the two without having to squint down and look at the number on the page. I can immediately see if there's some sort of conversion that I need to be aware of. But even more importantly, if I'm starting at a certain point and I can't remember what the previous tempo is, it's really helpful to have both tempos written at that change.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, any other thoughts about Soldier's Tale before we move on?
Just that it's hard.
Yes.
And I found one thing to really help that was to minimize the motion on any of the small beats.
Yeah.
Really, people wanted to see downbeats and they wanted to see the clarity of they wanted to see clearly differentiated subdivisions. So if it was a 2 versus a 3, it had to be over exaggerated. And I don't mean to say like it has to be obnoxious, but it has to be, it has to work. It has to be so clear that when you're doing like 2 plus 3, for instance, like the 2 portion of the beat has to be, or of the bar has to be much smaller than the 3 portion. Mm-hmm. If there's more sound in between that space, that sort of thing. Otherwise people would just get confused and it was awfully hard to lock it in.
Yeah. You have to be compact. And this is another, shout out, for conducting technique of using the baton, because you have to make these really small movements that need to be seen. So if you're not using a stick and you're having to use your forearm, you're having to use these big muscles that aren't as nimble as quite like using your fingers and your wrist. So you making those small movements with your baton is going to work and it's going to read. But if you can't execute with small movements, it's going to get muddy and it's going to get slow and it's just not going to happen. So get that baton, get that wrist moving, everybody.
I think you hit the nail on the head, Larry.
Yeah.
One of my teachers at the time actually recommended something that his teacher taught him, which was to take a music stand, put it flat, so like as if you were going to put a score down on it, and then raise it to the point where it's level with your conducting arm at a ready position, and then to just slide your arm forward on the stand over the edge of the stand the long way so that your wrist and only your wrist was free, and then practice conducting that way. Mm-hmm. And it really gets you to focus on using the tip of the baton sort of like a paintbrush to just be really specific and detailed with as little motion as possible. That was something that just hours of practice in the practice room, really. This is not something we do a lot, I guess, where we think, oh, we have to practice the motion anymore. But like, yes, we do constantly. Yay. Anything new, anything that requires a little extra, it's got to be just the physical muscle memory has to be practiced, I think.
Yeah. And I don't always do this, but oftentimes when I'm my very first semester of conducting students, I have them conduct just a major scale with using just their wrist, just up and down, up and down. And I'm like, look, everybody can see that. And all you did was just move your wrists up and down. So that's a case for not overworking and literally getting in the way of your conducting technique by moving too much and being, you know, too active. So anyway, yes, good conducting pedagogy tips right there. The other thing I just want to say about this piece, just a small thing. I just love the way it ends with the drums just sort of drifting off into nothing. And I have it, you know, in my score here, I stopped conducting, after the last two chords played by the violinist and let's let the percussion player do it. And I've noticed something that, when it's performed as a performance with the theatrical elements to it, it has this decrescendo and it kind of drifts away. But I have heard some performances of the suite where it crescendos into this big, loud kind of conclusion. And I just thought that was kind of interesting that, it is, you know, it can end in two different ways, or that's a tradition that's developed. So I don't know if you guys have noticed that, but I thought that was kind of weird. We ended it with the quiet sort of dying away thing, which is just kind of really eerie and spooky. And,
you know. Do you know where that tradition comes from, or what?
I don't know.
That is?
No, I don't know. I don't know what that's all about. So there you go.
I'm gonna hop on the old Google.
Yeah, you figure that out for us, Manel, and get back to us. All right. Well, that's Soldier's Tale.
Hold on. Before we leave this, I want to you know talk two things.
Okay.
About this real quick. You know, both of you mentioned about, you know, technique that is required for this, and you know, one thing that I think that we can really discuss in Stravinsky is the fact that, you know, for as artistic as we have to be as conductors, in Stravinsky, the conductor is more or less a metronome and a timekeeper. But, you know, if you try to study a Stravinsky score in the same way that you try to, like, study a Brahms score, like, oh, I'm going to take rubato here, or, you know, you listen to, you know, 20 different recordings of the opening of the first symphony, and you're going to get 20 different tempo interpretations. And you're not getting that with Stravinsky. You're getting relatively the same, you know, quality and consistency of tempo differentiation over and over. And I think that Stravinsky is one of those composers where if you practice your pattern and if you practice, you know, absolutely everything precisely the way that he wrote it, and you're just very clear in how you conduct it according to your practice, it's gonna work. You can't always say that about every composer, that it's just if you just practice the pattern and if you just, you know, it doesn't always work that way, but mm-hmm. It does with Stravinsky. And lastly, you know, if, you know, we can always say that there are instruments, and you know, with this piece, everyone's a soloist, and mm-hmm. the percussion part especially is quite challenging. But really, if there is any instrumentalist that afterwards the conductor should be like, I owe you a coffee or a wind down beverage, it should be your bass player, because your bass player is constantly am I on the beat or am I off the beat?
Yes.
And for how much repetition they have to do going back and forth with an ostinato, bum, 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 depending on whatever the conductor is conducting, but having that bum, 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 they deserve a beer.
Yeah, this piece, you're right, everybody's a soloist, but that bass part is crazy. And I don't know if I mentioned this, when I did it, it was a faculty concert. So it was all faculty members doing it, because this is not for beginners. This is a really challenging piece. And our percussion faculty at the college put it all together, because, you know, it's got such a cool percussion part. And he's like, let's do this. And so we... Lynn was the inspiration for that, but yeah, it was a challenging thing, to be sure. So not for for very good amateurs, we'll put it that way, but not for intermediate amateurs. That's definitely true. Great.
I think I may have a solution.
Oh, what you got for
question us? Of alternate endings? It's not an alternate ending. So apparently it's a question of which edition is used and what Storinsky sanctioned versus what's in his manuscript. So the older the recording, the more likely apparently it is to have the older percussion crescendo at the end of the piece, which according to one gramophone article I found, Stravinsky himself never sanctioned. So that I and another article I found from Naxos about a recording of theirs states that the crescendo was in the manuscript. However, the published score and all the newer editions of the score do have the diminuendo. So it's another one of those Stravinsky discrepancies that I can't find a satisfying solution for.
So it's a fielder's choice. Whatever you're feeling at the end.
Just from what I've glanced at here briefly, my gut tells me that the diminuendo is most likely the option that Stravinsky wanted.
Okay.
But I don't know for sure.
All right. Well, there you go. Well, thank you for that reporting on performance practice. All right. Very good. Well, gentlemen, about time we wrap this thing up. I just want to say one more thing about Stravinsky, and this is so true of so many composers of the 20th century, of how differently their lives would have been if he hadn't come to America. He gets a gig, I think a temporary gig, teaching or lecturing or something at Harvard, but he moves to America in September 1939. September 1939, moving from France to the United States was a pretty good move.
Before the outbreak of World War II.
September 1st, 1939, Germany invades Poland, start of World War II, and he's out later that month. I'm just saying, like, good timing on getting that gig at Harvard.
Yeah, seriously.
You know,
it was.
Yeah, I mean, and I, you know, you don't know what would happen. He could have left, you know, some other way. But he does, by the end of the war, he becomes a U.S. citizen in 1945. And he settles in Los Angeles, and that's the second half of his career. And who was it, Schoenberg, who also came over during the war years, I think? Yeah. So anyway, it's just you think about somebody's output in these composers and like, oh, they did this piece in this year and this year and this year. And sometimes it's important to remember the context when these things are written. The history and how it affects these composers' lives has always fascinated them. I like to get into the stuff that was happening around them. That's always been something I found fascinating. And when I saw that he moved to America in September 1939, it just lit up in my head, like, man, that's a good time to get a gig outside of Europe, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, yeah. Who? I think it was it Klemperer that also fled in the 30s.
I don't know.
Out of Germany and, gosh, who else? Yeah, Schoenberg in I think 1933. If the article that I'm reading is right. Heifetz came to America in 1917, but then became a naturalized citizen in 1925. Korngold, it looks like, also came over to LA in 1934, fleeing anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is we could go on and on and on, but
what year did Prokofiev come over?
Right around the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, and then he moved back to Russia in 1932, maybe. It was right around the time of Stalin. See, he kind of got the wrong time, right? He moved back to Russia right as Stalinism was ramping up, and died the same day as Stalin. Oddly enough,
Moscow in 1936. After traveling between Moscow and Paris for a few years, and I think he was in Russia during World War II, wasn't he?
Yeah, he lived in Russia all the way from that period till 1953 when he died. Like I said, the same day that Stalin did.
Which makes
the
sense.
The same day that Stalin died.
Yeah. Bad timing.
I mean, if you listen to his music, it's like I don't know how he could have written any of that and not been there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the Fifth Symphony, for instance, 1944, it's like clear machinery of war in that symphony.
Yeah.
It's just great, yeah.
Yeah. And Alexander,
I think that I would love to compare three different works of that era. I think it was between 1944 and 1945, and I know Matt, you're going to hate me for one of them, but we really should look at the you know.
Wait, hold on.
Because we've had this discussion before. Your favorite piece in the entire world, Copland 3.
Finlandia? Oh, no. Copland 3.
But we should look at Copland 3 and Shostakovich 7 and Prokofiev 5, all written, you know, between that era of 1944 to 1945. Because they all are somewhat, I think, saying just so much of the same thing in music.
Yeah. You know, it'd be kind of interesting to look at, do a whole war years look at music of the war years and see how that was responded to in different parts of the world, depending upon what country they're in.
Shostakovich wrote several symphonies during the war, I think 7, 8, and 9.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
Yeah, I mean, I think 4 through 10, I think, are considered the war symphonies. Which is, you know, interesting that even though 4 was written during that time, that it wasn't premiered until after the 10th. But
I feel like we should all know these. And I'm slightly embarrassed. Dr. Baldwin, please don't drive off the road if you're listening.
Oh, he's going to call you up and take your degree back. All right. Well, let's at the risk of completely driving off the show, shall we bring the maestro up and get on to our rant? All right, Matt, what's the rant for the day?
Oh boy, does the maestro sound unhappy. I will be honest that the book that I was eagerly anticipating devouring this past week.
About, yes, your nerd moment from last week.
Yes, correct. Yeah, I was really excited to dive into this book about this possibly intelligently made by aliens object called Oumuamua that came through the solar system in 2017. That book was less about the purported title and more about the author. So, I mean, it was more of an autobiography than anything. I was just a little disappointed in that because it seemed like the information that was in the book I had already read in the author's articles. So I felt a little let down. But I will say that the author does an excellent job of going into detail on the physics of the object and why he makes the statements that he makes, and it's just fascinating to think that there could have been this object, this extrasolar object that was visiting us that might be a piece of space trash left over from an ancient civilization. I mean, at the risk of sounding like a kook, and I know, you know, I kind of live on the edge anyway.
You're our kook though.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. No, I think what makes this conceivable is if we think about humanity and how old humanity is as a civilization, the things that we've launched outside of our solar system, which we have, Voyager probes, Pioneer, those are the only three I can think of at the moment. Those objects have left the solar system, and if they were going fast enough, we're talking, you know, a good proportion of the speed of light here, they would reach nearby star systems in years, but they would get there as long as they don't crash into something. So I think that alone makes it possible that there could be other civilizations out there that have done the same thing, only if they've been around a lot longer than us, they've probably launched a whole bunch more space trash than us, so, or probes or whatever, what have you. So anyway, I just loved the idea of thinking about the possibilities. If I always like to say, if I wasn't a musician, I'd be a plow driver or weatherman or an astrophysicist. I always forget about that one, but I just think it's fascinating. So my rant is more of a nerd moment of my own making, really, because I felt a little bit let down. I'm just used to a bit more of a scholarly approach, I suppose. The book was clearly written for the layperson in mind. So,
I see.
At risk of being sued for libel, I will stop there.
fair enough. And hey, you know, Matt, if you want to get a little work on your plow driving dreams, we got the day for you. Get out there.
As soon as we're done here, I'm taking that shovel outside, putting my boots on, and I'm gonna snow plow the, you know what, out of the sidewalks.
Hey, man, Come on down to Fourth Avenue when you're done. Although we have a homeowners association that does it, so we don't have to worry about that. I have lived in Salt Lake for 9 years and have shoveled zero snow from the sidewalk. I've only unburied my car a few times.
Are you kidding me? That's my favorite part of living in a cold climate is shoveling.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good. Good for you. Good for you.
Yeah, gym membership, right?
Yeah. Well, no, I live in an apartment. I live in an apartment, so I don't have to worry about it. That's what the homeowners association is for. All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us again today. And McKeever, stay warm up there in northern climates. It's cold here, but man, is it cold in Wisconsin? God.
Yeah, it's freezing. I think the next week. We have, you know, highs in the teens, lows in the negatives.
Oh, God.
Like negative 40.
Something like that. So, you know, at least I got some Stravinsky and some good coffee to keep me warm.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, oh my goodness.
It won't keep you warm. I'll light a fire under anything.
Soldier's Tale score will be a quick burn.
Oh, hey now. Don't burn the scores.
That's what you say now. Just wait. Give it a few days and then, you know. We'll see.
I'll let you know if I'm still alive. It's good.
That candle will still be burning years from now, I'm sure.
Perfect. Perfect.
All right. Well,
hey, thanks again for having me, guys.
Absolutely. Yes, say hey to Ashley for us.
The crew, basically.
I love it.
Well, of
if
course.
You send us coffee, you're in.
No, he is crew. Him and Brandon, that's the crew.
It's the crew.
I don't want him to think that he can't send us coffee.
Oh, okay. Well, he has to keep current. So it's like, yeah, as long as tribute keeps arriving,
your membership dues are due.
I was just gonna say that I got to pay my membership. It's fine.
All right, very good. Well, Matt, stay warm up in Wisconsin. Other Matt, stay warm here in Salt Lake, and we'll get together in person eventually someday. And McKeever, say hey to Ashley for us, and we'll see you soon.
Promise I will. Thanks, guys.
All right, thanks everybody, and we will see you next week.
Cheers.